Today, I want to tell you a three-part story about wrestling, or as some folks where I'm from would proudly say, wrestling. You ever notice the thing about wrestling is that you can't wrestle yourself? You ever tried that? It would be pretty foolish rolling around on the floor by yourself like that. Give it a shot if you want. The thing about wrestling is, though, no, it always takes two forces opposing each other. It's always a struggle between two parties. But the story I want to tell you today isn't just a story about wrestling. It's also about a quilt banner. And that's where our story begins. Part 1, The Church. Picture it, 1990, North Carolina. Little 10-year-old Zachary's in bed, where most nights he's got his Walkman headphones on and he's listening to Whitney Houston sing on the Bodyguard soundtrack. There was nothing better. But one particular night, I wasn't listening to Whitney Houston. I found myself laying in bed, wrestling with the fate of my eternal soul at a young age of 10 years old. I can't believe it looking back on it. I didn't want to go to hell, of course, but also didn't want to go to church every Sunday of my life, meaning I had to get dressed up and wear those uncomfortable shoes and that necktie. But weighing those two options, I figured a necktie and uncomfortable shoes sounded somewhat better than an eternity in hellfire and brimstone. So next morning, I told my mom that I wanted to take Jesus into my heart, as we would say. And mom told the pastor, and the next Sunday, I walked down the aisle. Walked down the aisle, flanked on either side by church banners that would become models for the piece I'm telling you about today. But the years pass, and that tie got a little tight. I was no longer going to church. You know, I don't believe in the idea of original sin anymore. But I do believe that we're born into a world of other people's sins or decisions. I really like the way the old Norse folks used to think about time. You know, here in the West, we often divide our time with past, present, and future. It seems so obvious. It's like describing water. But for the old Norse folks, the past was only what is. The present is what is becoming. And the future they referred to as what shall be. So one more time, think about that. The past is what is. The present is becoming. And the future is what shall be. And what I love about that conception of time is that it helps us realize that we are living in the middle of the fruit of history. We are surrounded by everything that's ever happened. That's how we got here. We are born into a world of other people's decisions, but that doesn't absolve us from the responsibility of working to right those wrongs. What do we do in this world of other people's making that we found ourselves born into? Part 2, The Dream. So fast forward 30 years, I'm back in bed, a little bit older now, and I had a dream. In this dream, I saw a guy with kind eyes and big bushy sideburns, and I knew in the way that you know in dreams that it was my great-great-grandfather, Hiram Duguid. Hiram was a Kentucky farmer, grew up with his daddy owning slaves on their small plantation. He carried those memories and those stories with him. They didn't make their way down to me. They got lost in history between him and me. Southern white amnesia. But in this dream, Hiram shows up and he's got this writhing snake, this poisonous asp, just mad as hell, wriggling in his hands. And Hiram reaches out his hands and gives me that snake. I said, "Whoa, buddy, I don't want that snake." And we push it back and forth for what felt like most of the night. You know how dream time works. And in this dream, I found myself wrestling between two forces. One, not wanting to get bit, and two, knowing that something had to be done to control this venomous snake. That next morning, I woke up, and the dream ends with me holding this snake in my hands, still mad as hell, but now it's mine. It's no longer my great-great-grandfather's. It left me with this sense that the work of the living is to figure this stuff out, to set right the wrongs of the past. The dead can only do so much to help us untangle these knots, and future generations, we don't want to pass this on to them. So it is up to us, here and now in the present, the what is becoming, to do something different. There's a long and storied history of snake handling in the Appalachian Mountains. You've probably heard about some of the small churches tucked away deep in a hall or somewhere. They would take a couple verses out of the Bible, and they built a whole practice of faith around it. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read you a couple verses right now from the book of Mark in the New Testament. "And these signs shall follow them that believe. In my name they shall cast out devils. They shall speak with new tongues. They shall take up serpents. And if they drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them. They shall lay hands on the sick, and they shall recover." All that sounds beautiful to me. I love that. For some people reading that verse in the Appalachian region, they took that as a test of faith. And it makes me think, what's my faith? What am I willing to stick my hand in a box with a poisonous serpent and risk my life in order to show this I believe? That gets us to my third wrestling story for you. Part 3, The Banner. Fast forward to just last year, I was at the winter residency at Pinland in the mountains of North Carolina. I decided to take that dream that I had with Hiram Duguid and turn it into a piece for Southern White Amnesia. With this idea in mind, I snaked my way down the mountain. It was this hairpin driveway. It took about 10 minutes to drive all the way down from Pinland at the top to the town at the bottom. But when I got there, I went straight to the one thrift store in town, and I said, well, this will be a fun creative limitation for me. I'm going to get all of my materials at this one place because I didn't have a choice. There wasn't any other thrift store to go to. So this is going to be fun. I walk into that thrift shop, y'all, and I find this beautiful iridescent green and brown upholstery that was almost scale-like. I was like, whoa, the universe wants me to make this quilt. I also grabbed some commercial lace that had this really interesting weave to it. And just because who doesn't like a little bling, I picked up 2 bundles of tasseled fringe. All of this would go into the piece that I made there at Pinland. I love working with repurposed materials. You've heard me talk about it before. These materials already have a past, and yet, at the same time, they are what is with us today. So I took these materials, and I'm not going to lie, I added some stuff from the scrap bins at the studio, but that feels like, you know, I'm not cheating. It was just right there on the floor, basically. You know how that works. And I started arranging this piece. First thing I did was roll out that big piece of upholstery I had, and it turned out to be a much bigger piece. You never know when they're taped up in those big rolls how much you got. But this piece ended up being almost 2.5 yards tall. It's massive, about 1.5 yards wide. Then I took that lace curtain and I started cutting up in strips because I knew that I wanted to have this graphic snake writhing its way from the bottom of the banner to the top. I took a pink shirt that I had gotten from the thrift store as well, cut out the lettering snake handler. I liked it because it's semi-sheer and almost felt like a highlighter or something had been written on it because you can see that upholstery underneath it. The eye of the snake and the rest of the lettering comes from this really angry red flannel. When you look close, it's hard to see from a distance, but when you look close, there's all these symbols of the West, of the cowboy West, right? You have little skulls and cactuses and lassos and cowboy hats and things, which didn't feel altogether inappropriate for a piece like this. The text that nestles itself between the curves of the snake's body says, "Now take up thy serpent today," alluding back to those verses from Mark. Very much sidewalk prophet style language is what I'm going for here. I signed it big and bold in the bottom corner, Zach 1:29, as if I were my own Bible verse or something. But really, it was just that I finished it on January 29th. And all along 3 of the 4 sides of this banner, that glorious fringe trim I told you about. This piece, very much in the spirit of that sidewalk prophet, is a call to action. That snake that my great-grandfather gave me in the dream, the snake of inherited wealth from exploited black labor, what do I do with those privileges and those benefits? How do I meet the challenges of racial reckoning? How do I handle this snake? So I told you this was a story about wrestling. When I was making this piece, what was I wrestling with? I gotta be vulnerable, y'all, and I'm telling you the truth in the hopes that something it touches something in you, gives you a chance to reflect on your own situation. And that is, when I was making this piece, I was wrestling between my desire for justice. I want a world where everybody is at home, accepted for who they are and given everything they need, where nobody has more than anybody else. But I was also wrestling with the fact that I benefit from certain privileges, and I'm used to those privileges. I like having them. I mean, that's the nature of privilege, right? Would I be willing, for example, to give up opportunities in the form of artist residencies, let's say? Would I be willing to give up my money to go towards reparations? Would I be willing to give up my time, maybe by taking action in the street? These are questions I have. These are questions I live with. These are what I was wrestling with and thinking about when I was making the snake handler piece. Remember, it always takes two forces to wrestle. It's real easy to say, oh, I want a fair and equitable world. Who doesn't? But what's keeping us from going all in and making that world a reality? That's the wrestle, right? What is that other thing? That's what we got to figure out. And that is one of the forms that the snake takes. So let's talk about how to handle this snake. I guess this particular part of the conversation is geared towards other white folks. Listen to me talk right now. If you're listening to this right now and you're not a white person, you're part of the global majority, you are still more than welcome here in this conversation. Thank you for being here. And I welcome your feedback. I'll put my email in the show notes below. Know that I receive all feedback as a sign of respect. I've gotten lots of good feedback before, so it won't be the first time, and I'm sure it won't be the last. But I do value it because it's how I grow and see the world for how it truly is. So with all that said, how do we handle the snake? I've got a few ideas that have been helpful to me that I'll share with you, but these are by no means a prescription or formula. Everybody's going to go about this their own way. So take what works for you and pass on the rest. Number one, first things first, we got to see the snake. Part of the trick of whiteness is that it makes people think that whiteness isn't a thing, right? That's just the way things are. If you want a little insight into how much of an identity whiteness is, check out hashtags like hashtag white people, hashtag white people Wednesday, hashtag white people white people, right? Like, it will give you a really keen insight into the kinds of things that people see white people as. Because whiteness is a culture. It stems from Puritanism, the ideas of westward expansion, individualism, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. All of that is largely associated with whiteness. But so many of us white folks just view it as the way things are. So once you see the snake, you got to learn its ways. And there's a lot of ways to do that. But this seems like a good chance to tell you about three books that have really informed my thinking over the last few years. Number one is This Here Flesh by Cole Arthur Riley, aka Black Liturgies on Instagram. In this memoir, biography, set of meditations, Cole, who envisions herself as a Black contemplative, walks us through her experience moving through this world as a Black person, as someone who identifies as female, as someone with health issues, as someone who thinks about the spiritual dimension of things. I can't recommend this book enough, and I can't recommend the audiobook enough. Cole reads it herself, and her voice is absolutely hypnotic. So, This Here Flesh. Second book that I really loved was by Ruth King, Mindful of Race, Transforming Racism from the Inside Out. Ruth is a really big advocate of everybody talking to everybody, of course, but she says it's especially important for white folks to talk to white folks because we're the ones that know the inner workings of the snake. We built the snake, right? We know the mechanism of the mind of the snake, and it takes us to unwork those mechanisms. Ruth King is an international teacher who comes at her racial equity work through a lens of mindfulness. So it can be really interesting to see how those two come together. And then lastly, White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo spells out in very stark terms what white folks often miss about themselves as a culture. Right? So if you want some specifics on who hashtag white people are, check out White Fragility. Once we've seen the snake and we've learned its ways, it's time to start taming the snake. Right? Two of my favorite things, and I share them with you just so you have them in your back pocket. If they're helpful for you, feel free to use them. Long time ago, I had a good friend who, whenever we were on vacation and someone started to bring up work, she would just say, ouch, and that was it. And that was our subtle agreed upon cue to realize that, hold on a second, we just crossed the line, you know? And I like the idea of ouch as a ready-made boilerplate response, because so much of the time when we're in conversations with white folks and we hear them say something about people of color, we want to jump in. But by the time we've thought of our response, the moment has passed and it feels awkward and how do we go back and all that. But if you just say, ouch, you don't have to think about it. Just say, ouch. It buys us time to think about a fuller response. And a fuller response might be, this is the second thing I would share with you, especially talk with family and other folks. When I hear something hurtful, I would say, I have friends that would be really hurt by that idea if they were here. And what I like about that response is that, one, it contextualizes it in relationships. I have friends. We keep the focus on the idea that was just expressed and not the person, right? They'd be hurt by the idea if they were here. That phrase, if they were here, feels important to me because it points out, it makes visible to everyone in that space that there probably aren't any people of color in that space. And that's why that idea was able to be expressed. So there's a lot of power in that phrase. I have friends that would be hurt by that idea if they were here. So if those two ideas are helpful for you, please use them. If you got some, I would love to hear them. Beyond that, beyond seeing the snake and learning its ways and taming it, the work is up to you to figure out exactly what it is you got to do in your life, in your world, in your space with your people. Be willing to receive feedback in any way anybody wants to give it. It won't be easy, but growth rarely is, right? I look forward to that future day, that day of jubilee, when all humans suddenly get a big consciousness upgrade. But until then, y'all, we got some work to do. And I look forward to working right alongside you. I'll be back soon with another part of this story. The one about how some of our babies were born with a snake in their crib, when I share with you about another quilted piece called Our Children. But until then, I hope you're well, I hope you're sowing something good, and I hope to see you soon. Take care.